guess what I'd like to do is sort of, reconstruct the last tape we did, and just start by asking you to talk a bit about, first your name and where you were born and how you ended up in BC.
Heavens, way back there. That's a long way back. How did I end up in BC? I started in BC, up in the Selkirk Mountains, in a little mining village just south of Revelstoke. I was born in the mining town of Trout Lake and later lived in Beaton, BC. And then later again in the mining village of Camborne, which is quite close to the others. It was a silver lead mining area, and about the time I was born in 1909, the mining industry had fallen apart. My dad had come into that country with a touring theatrical group, the Fraser Repertory Players, and while there, he met with a man named Almus Vars, who had been offered an opportunity to buy a department store in Trout Lake, which was quite a flourishing mining town, at such a bargain that they both felt they should jump for it. Now, Trout Lake at that time had its own fire department, its own hospital, and even to this day, one of the old red fire plugs can be seen on the lakefront. And in any event, they very soon discovered they'd bought at the wrong end of a boom in mining, and the whole country, as well as the Beaton, Trout Lake, and Camborne, were in a state of collapse. No, we better push it off till we see where we go from there. First tape, I thought, when I was thinking back over it, I thought I had rather overdone the tape. In any event, it wasn't terribly long until Trout Lake City was in a complete state of collapse, and my mother and dad had to move to Beaton, BC, which is where they were when the First World War broke out in August 1914. I can remember sitting under the table and hearing them discuss how the war really wouldn't last very long, because the Balkans were always in an uproar, and this was doubtless just another one of those things. But maybe I should point out that although in 1914 I was only 5 years of age, I had already been well-rooted in Scottish nationalist history. Both my mother and father were extremely fond of reading to their children and encouraging their children to read at a very early age, explaining words to them. And we had heard all about Robert the Bruce and how he's inspired by the spider to try, try, try again. And this was really a very strong culturing for us, and one that I think every one of us has maintained throughout our lives, although we came to understand that there was more to history than the wrongs done to Scotland, and particularly to the Highlands, by the English government. Anyway, in 1914, my dad, who had been educated at Queen's College in Kingston, Ontario, and had been part of the Queen's Own Rifles there, saw an opportunity of getting out of the awful hole he was in, being the postmaster and the road foreman and the person with the telephone franchise and the recording of vital statistics for that area. Saw an opportunity to get away from this humdrum life, and he tried to enlist, as a good many men did, to get away from the facts of everyday living. And my mother was pregnant at that time with the fourth child, and ultimately was to have the fifth. Now, she had had her first three children in less than 3 years, and she was a woman in her middle 30s when I was born, or maybe even better than her middle 30s. So, and she'd had the twin daughters 10 years previous to me by her first husband, who had died in a railway accident. So she must have been kind of fed up with the sight of young ones coming along, I think. But the war came along. My father tried to enlist. He couldn't make it. He couldn't manage it. And then in 1916, he was still carrying on as a road foreman. He was an inveterate smoker. And we conclude that he walked into the powder magazine for the road work with a lighted pipe, or else he even was so absent-minded as to strike a match in there to light his pipe, and the whole magazine blew up. And he was the only person there, but it blew him totally to pieces. So my mother was left. By that time, my mother had borne the fifth child in 1915, and she was left with five very young children, the youngest one a baby in arms, and I was between 7 and 8, or between 8 and 9. What would I be in 1915, 1916? I would be between 7 and 8 years of age. Mm-hmm. I always believe I had to be 8 years of age for the things that I did. But she encouraged us. Now, my father had always raised us very independently, because he felt that even though I was a girl and my second youngest, we were both girls, that we should be able to do, we should feel confident in ourselves and be able to do the things that boys did also. So he had let us use knives and hatchets and the kind of picks that are used in mines and all that sort of thing. He never kept us away from his tools or from the grinder for sharpening knives and axes. In fact, the grinder was our early hobby horse. We used to sit on there and send the old grinder grinding wheel around and around. Mm. And when my mother had to undertake earning the money for the family, she just took over where my dad left, with the exception of the road foremanship. And she took on the post office mining recording and recording of vital statistics and the telephone. And my little sister, who was 2 years younger than I was, answered the telephone from the time she was about 6 years of age. She was really good at answering the telephone if mother was busy. It's the most remarkable thing. And we got in. All the men had left from that country. Every man who could possibly get into the army went out right away to enlist.
Because it was so depressed? And
to have a job, yes, because the conditions were so abominable. There was absolutely nothing doing in silver lead. There was plenty of lead elsewhere in the world for making the munitions. And my mother encouraged and insisted that I make bannocks and powder, baking powder biscuits and bread. I kneaded down bread at first. I just kneaded it down, but I managed to do it. And make the cocoa and get the kids ready for school in the morning, make the porridge, and generally look after things. We had a pretty fair run, quite a few blocks to go to school. But we usually came home for lunch.
What about education? How long were you able to stay in school?
Well, we didn't even start school until after my father had been killed. And then, see, when we were young, there weren't six children of 6 years of age to form enough of a group to bring in a school teacher. So I didn't get to school until I was 8 years of age. And then I only stayed in school from that time until I was 14. That was all the formal schooling I ever had. But on the other hand, we had the kind of schooling that a lot of young people miss, because we had access to a most excellent library. We were encouraged to use it. We were shown how to use it. There was an insistence that if we did not understand the meaning of a word, we immediately went to a huge Oxford dictionary and looked up not alone the word, but the roots. And then toward the end of my period in school, I had the great good fortune to be taught by an English schoolmaster first, who is insistent that his Canadian students would understand the English language thoroughly. Greek roots, Latin roots, Anglo-Saxon roots. And we had a thoroughly fine, absolutely an excellent grounding in English word roots as well as grammar. And then following him, we had Miss McQueen, a Scottish background school teacher from Cape Breton in Nova Scotia, who was much the same.
After your dad died and you...
1916, yeah.
And your mother was working, were the conditions really difficult for your family in terms of...
Oh, they must have been appallingly difficult. Now, we didn't have the feeling of this as youngsters. We were told there were things that we couldn't have, and we were encouraged not to wear shoes in the summertime, which was didn't require a great deal of urging, you know. And we were also encouraged in the wintertime to wear, both girls, to wear boys' boots because they wore longer. Mm-hmm. And but we didn't feel oppressed and we didn't feel poverty-stricken because my mother didn't dwell on that aspect of it. But I do know that she had an appalling time buying a ton or so of coal for the winter time, and I know she had an awful time with the inflation, just from things that were dropped, you know, brought to my consciousness every once in a while. But really, our home life was so happy, and we had such a good time together as five children, even though we had Frank, we always considered our baby brother Frank an awful pest. Still, we didn't mind looking after him all that much, you know. He was part of the entire group. There was a solid feeling, a collective feeling of doing things together.
When did you leave the mountains?
In 1920, I think it was.
And where did your family go?
And we stopped for a short time in Victoria, B.C. My mother married again to a man, a mining engineer she had met up in that area, a man named Corey Manhennick. And then we went on to Salt Spring Island. And I was, at this time, I would be 1921, I would be, between 11 and 12, I guess. 11 and 12, see. Yeah, I think that's what it would be, definitely.
And then you lived on a farm?
We lived on the farm on Salt Spring Island from that time until I was between 17 and 18 years of age.
What kind of work did you do on the farm?
I did everything on the farm. I was the first one up always to milk cows. I was reasonably good in the house, but I would much prefer to be out digging the garden, plowing, riding the horses, driving the sheep, looking after the pigs and the chickens, any of those things, rather than doing the housework. We had to carry all our water, too, when we were on Salt Spring Island. We had no water piped in at all, and it all had to be carried in buckets and tubs. When you carry water in a tub, you have two people doing it and you have a bucket in the other hand. You carry one tub and two buckets in order to balance off well and to get the max amount of water in. But we carried water for the garden, we carried water for the stock. Seems absolutely, to me, absolutely unbelievable that people didn't build little flumes, you know, and
irrigate.
Yeah, little flumes or little trenches to carry that water in. Anyway, that's the way it was done. But we had an awfully good time, and the area of Salt Spring that we lived in was surrounded with a sea full of sea trout and salmon and cod and crabs and oysters and clams. Living was really, really very, very good there. And I'm a peasant at heart, Sarah. I really enjoyed weeding those long, long rows of vegetables and hoeing in the garden and all that sort of thing. At the same time, we had a lot of time because we didn't have TV in those days, and we did have radio. We had radio from about 1921 or 22 on, but it didn't occupy so much time.
Worked, lived on your farm from 1921 to 1928. What prompted you to begin to look for work outside of your family and outside of the farm?
Well, actually, it was, you see, we had been raised with this attitude that it was necessary to be independent. That even though we were female, still that didn't mean that we didn't support ourselves, and things weren't very good in the financial terms, and there were the younger brothers, and my sister was going to high school. I had the opportunity to go to high school as an extreme privilege, and I had been raised so independently. I was so bloody indignant over this. I refused to go to high school on this basis that I wasn't going to be grateful to anyone for an education. It was my right. And as I remarked before, here's somebody coming.
This was of a woman in this area that
you Yeah. Why isn't this making any noise? Oh,
to fences and throwing themselves under horses' hooves and that sort of thing. She really couldn't approve of that. And it's a strange thing, Sarah, that my mother was really a very ladylike, dainty, genteel sort of person, and yet she was capable of raising her daughters to be so very independent. She wanted us to go to tennis parties, know how to conduct ourselves, and that sort of thing, and dress properly for those things. But she also was very appreciative of the fact that we were strong and capable and could and would do farm work and ride horses and throw sheep around and that, all that sort of thing, and handle bales of hay, thresh grain, and so on. She was very, very strong in her admiration of us for doing these things, even though she did want us to conduct ourselves nicely at all the tennis parties we really had to go to. In any event, by the time I was between 17 and 18 years of age, I had come to the conclusion that I was getting absolutely no money out of the farm. Everything that we made on that farm went back into holes in the ground in the Selkirk Mountains, in all the marvelous claims and concentrators, mine machinery of one sort and another that my stepfather had. And well, we picked tons of apples every year. Sometimes as high as 20 and 25 tons of apples were sent over here to Vancouver to the Empress Manufacturing Company, which is still going. It's still part of McDonald's Consolidated, the Safeway outfit. You'll find these names still on tins of jam in the grocery shops. In any event, I had a very great friend in a local school teacher who was acquainted with the possible opportunities for jobs over here on the mainland. And Irene suggested that I apply as a child care person for a woman she knew who had a raspberry farm. So I did this, and I came over to Hatsik, where there were huge acreages of small fruit at that time, nearly all now gone. I looked after these two little boys, and I did a bit of the cooking over there because I was quite capable. And then my employer, Mrs. Waterfall, said that I was so very good at caring for the children and generally looking after the house and assisting her cooking for her berry pickers, she recommended me to a woman also living in Hatzik who was a most interesting elderly woman with a huge farm out there, and I was to be the housekeeper under this woman's attention, and do all the washing and the cooking and all the indoor sort of work and help her in her huge flower garden. She had a very beautiful flower garden. So I settled out there for a couple of years and had a very pleasant time there. Let's just stop for a moment. Well, I cared for her. I was on duty, so to speak, 24 hours a day. Now, she was a very fine woman, but she was a woman past 70, getting up toward 80 when I was there. I think she was 78 or something like that. And she had these appalling seizures of diarrhea late at night and an awful mess up, and I would have to go in and clean her up, and then the next day or two I would have to administer this extract of wild strawberry to her in the proper quantities. She had daughters there, two daughters, one in Dewdney and the other one living right in Hatzik. But they were very nice women. One had a number of children of her own to look after, the other one just had one daughter. But they were quite satisfied that I was quite a responsible person to leave with their mother.
What were the wages like? And
oh, they were magnificent. I got $20 every month. And for that, I cooked for the harvesters, and I cooked for the other crews that came in, the haymaking crews of one sort and another. And I did all the washing, and some of the washing, I can assure you, was quite something to do. Solid linen sheets with fine lace edges, which all had to be rubbed out on the board and wrung by hand, all of them.
And this was during the early 1930s, was it?
This was 1928 and 29.
So it wasn't quite the Depression?
No, it wasn't quite the Depression, but there was there was that period following the First World War where there were ups and downs, you know, and sags and that sort of thing. And actually, there were many young women who were working for $15 a month. There were women who were actually working for a little pittance handed out for their car fare, and they weren't even getting the $20 a month.
What happened next? Did you continue to work at
Dennis? No, I met a friend of my first employer's, the Waterfalls, whose name was Ed Matthews, who was a mechanic in Mission, which is very close to Hatzik. And we shared a common interest in good music and good books and that sort of thing. And although he was 17 years older than I was, we became very close, and I married him in November of 1929. Now, this time, my mother had told me there was such a thing as contraception, but she hadn't told me how you go about it or anything. And I was astounded to find myself the following February. Well, actually, the following February, I didn't feel very well, and I'd always been a very well person. And then eventually, I discovered I was pregnant, which really was rather amazing. And my husband felt that I had let him down by becoming pregnant, and our relationship deteriorated very, very rapidly. He kept assuring me that this baby would be my baby, that I had let him down, and therefore I would have to bear the full responsibility for this child.
How old were you?
I was between 20 and 21 by this time. And as you can see by my background, I was pretty independent and pretty mad about all this thing. And then my family, too, took the attitude that I'd always been. My mother felt that I'd always been so terribly self-reliant and so sold on my own ability to cope with my own life. She thought it was a good comeuppance for me. And you know, in a way, she even used this term to me. In a way, it was, because up until that time, Sarah, I had felt that I was rather an exceptional woman, that I could do so many things that other women, that I did so many things that other women didn't do, that they could do them if they only had the attitude, which I think it was, has a considerable amount of truth in it. But at the same time, I had a very arrogant and unsisterly attitude to many, many of the women that I met. Not that I was unkind to them or anything, but I surely felt superior. Well, I was going to bear this child quite by myself. I didn't want to have a doctor. I didn't go near anybody. I continued, whenever I had the opportunity, riding horses, taking long hikes, going miles into the woods to mountain lakes to fish for trout with my husband. And in November, when my child was born, I had been to the doctor, I guess, maybe only 6 weeks before that time, because on one of my horseback riding days, it had been a little bit of a rough ride, and I rode bareback frequently, I began losing fluid, and I knew that that wasn't quite the right way that the thing should be happening. So I went to him, and he explained, well, you know, I better cool it a bit and be take things a little more easily. Oh, and I was digging all the garden and doing all that sort of thing. And I had a terribly hard time giving birth to that child. And in any event, how it all started was one noon, and I went down about 5 o'clock eventually to my doctor, and he had told me previously I wasn't going into the hospital because they had a very nasty infection at Golden Staff in the Mission Hospital. And he had arranged with Mrs. Innes, who was a nurse midwife and a friend of mine, that she would provide me with a room in which I could bear this child. Now, everyone thought, including myself, that I'd have absolutely no problem bearing this child. But when I went down to him at 5 o'clock, after having been actually in labor over the hours between 5 and 12, 5 hours, he said, well, now look, you're probably, this is your first child, you know, Mrs. Matthews, you're probably not going to have this baby until maybe noon tomorrow or something like that. And why don't you just go home, be a good girl, and settle down? Now, I'd walked all the way down the hill to his office, and I walked all the way back up the hill to my home after this. Yes, so I stayed at home until 10 o'clock that night, and it was in November 16 in 1930, and it was snowing, and it was very cold, and my husband had a Model T Ford, of which he was very fond. He called it Lizzie. And finally, I got Mrs. Innes to come down and take a look at me and see what was happening, because she lived just about a block and a half up the hill from where I lived. And she phoned the doctor immediately and told him that I simply had to, you know, that he simply had to attend me, and I had to go up to her place right away. So she turned to my husband and suggested to get the car out. And he turned to me and he said, oh, well, you really wouldn't want me to take Lizzie out on a night like this. It's just a little way up to Mrs. Innes's, and we'll both help you. You can surely walk up. So I was also very indignant, very mad about this, extremely angry about this. And I said, well, certainly I will walk up there. And walk up I did. I don't suppose it really did me any particular harm, because I just wasn't going to be able to bear that child anyway. And